portfolio.
One of the benefits or curses, as I perceived it in my youth, of growing up in a multi-generational clergy family is that I have heard a lot of sermons. Not just on Wednesday nights and Sunday mornings and Sunday nights, but almost every day of the week. My father cannot have a conversation without it ending up being a sermon. And I remember each Saturday night hearing my father or grandfather go through his Sunday morning sermon with his wife. I don't remember my mother or grandmother commenting or offering words of encouragement or suggestions for changes. I merely remember the practice. I paid no attention to the contents of those sermons during those Saturday night previews, or even on Sunday mornings for the most part. There was a time in my childhood when British invasion groups like the Beatles were causing a stir. And I remember my father gave a sermon that included the then popular song, Eleanor Rigby. Bridge Over Troubled Waters by Simon and Garfunkel was another song that found its way into one of his Sunday morning offerings. But other than those two particular sermons with cultural associations that piqued my interest, I don't remember anything else about the preaching of my father or my grandfather, with the exception of one sermon titled, Come Next Spring. Perhaps that sermon stuck with me all these years because my father preached it at every church he served during my growing up years, or perhaps I remember it because the theme of that certain sermon actually resonated with me. And I was actually paying attention, both of which seem highly unlikely, given my resistance to paying attention to my father in my youth. Whatever the reason, come next spring, those words in that sermon have remained in my mind for over 40 years. Recently, I decided that enough time had passed since my grandfather's death in 2002 that I could venture into reading the three published books of his sermons. They'd been in a prominent spot on my bookshelf for many years, but until the last couple of months, I thought that opening the pages and having the person I loved dearly revealed might be too emotional. In reading my grandfather's sermons, I'm learning a lot about him. He was a really good writer and tells story after story after story. I've also learned something about sermon stealing. I stood stunned when I read my grandfather's sermon titled, Tomorrow May Be Too Late, Today Must Count, in his book, Faith for These Troubled Times. And the sermon opened like this. Some months ago, I saw a movie which, because of its deep religious implications and teachings, might well have been shown in any church. It was entitled, Come Next Spring. My father had stolen my grandfather's sermon. Or were they in cahoots? I haven't gotten up the nerve to ask my dad about that. And since I don't remember the details of his sermon, I can never know how similar the two were, other than the overarching idea, which is so good that you're now going to be the beneficiaries of the third generational offering of Come Next Spring. The movie, my grandfather noted, was based in the Ozarks in the time shortly after World War I. I've not seen the movie, but it's affected me nonetheless. The movie, according to my grandfather, dealt with the joys, sorrows, hardships, and pleasures of that period and place. It was based on the often heard expression, come next spring. Come next spring, we'll plant a better crop than this one. Come next spring, we'll build a better house, or we'll make peace with our neighbors, or spend more time in prayer. We'll forgive our enemies and give up bad habits. Without much work or energy expended, our lives will change in all the ways we want them to change. Come next spring. And we may not use that phrase, come next spring, in our day-to-day conversations as the folks living in the Ozarks just out of World War I did. But we know the sentiment. We can resonate with their wishful and wistful way of thinking. We're more, or were more likely to use the phrase, "when I get around to it," at least until some wiseacre created a small round disc about the size of a quarter, inscribed with the words "around to it," T-U-I-T, which immediately eliminated that excuse. You now have a round to it. So you can, that excuse is now invalid. It seems, though, that procrastination, along with so many other problems of our human nature, have not evolved as prehensile tails or Neanderthal gates. Jesus dealt with this very same issue as he tried to bring folks into his fold and into the kingdom of heaven. He invites a man to join the cause as Jesus and his disciples are making their way to Jerusalem. But the man says, "Okay, but first let me go bury my father. When things change, when my father is no longer around, when he is dead and gone, I can follow you." Jesus said, "That sort of thinking doesn't get you anywhere but stuck. Go and proclaim the kingdom of God." Another person encountering Jesus comes up with another excuse. "I need to say goodbye before I take off." "Nope," Jesus says, "you don't need to do anything but follow me." And we may see these excuses for as valid reasons to wait before taking off for parts unknown. Surely Jesus doesn't want a person to desert his aging parents or not offer the proper farewell before taking off with his transient teacher. The reasons, excellent though they may be, valid as they may seem, important to proper relational interaction as they certainly are shown to be nothing more than stall tactics. Jesus says, "Get rid of the excuses. Stop putting up roadblocks that keep you from following me and entering the kingdom of God." There's no shortage of reasons that we can come up with to keep living the way we're living, doing things the way we've always done them, wishing and hoping that our lives will change with the wisps of the wind. Florence spent most of her time in her life in righteous indignation, absolutely secure in her distrust of and anger toward her sister, who had wronged her so many years before. She wasn't even sure where her sister lived, if her sister was still married, had her sister's children lived to adulthood, or had some horrible fate come upon them that had cut short their lives. Were there two children or three? It had been so long since they had spoken, she actually didn't really remember. She spent a great deal of her time and energy nursing her long-held anger and feelings of betrayal. The chasm between them often threatened to consume her as she spent hour upon hour rehashing, rethinking, replaying that heated and hate-filled conversation. Florence waited and waited for her sister to call and make amends, to apologize for her obvious wrongdoing. Maybe her sister did the same. The call never came from either side. Florence died angry and bitter and alone. Her certainty ate away every ounce of joy from her life. "Come next spring, my sister will call and tell me how wrong she was and beg my forgiveness." Next spring never came for Florence, and it may never come for us. What is it that we're waiting for? What roadblocks have we put up in the way of living fully into the kingdom of God? Paul notes that when we move beyond our regular ways of dealing in the world, when we stop coming up with excuses and let the Spirit of God take charge of our lives, we experience a variety of gifts, such as love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, generosity, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. The time is now. Let's not keep waiting for next spring to come. Next spring may be too late. No more excuses. The time is now.